Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, "And how much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." The Pharisees who loved money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of men, but God knows your hearts. What is highly valued among men is detestable in God's sight."
Yeah, friends, I got a taste for the freedom and the power and the speed of driving early on. One time when I was about 13 on my uncle's property, my parents weren't around and no one else was as far as I can remember except a friend of mine, Spike, and I, and we found an old ute behind one of the sheds. And it started when we turned the key on, so we figured, why not? And so, you know, at the grand age of 13, we took for a drive, and going forward was a bit of a difficulty because the clutch was something unfamiliar to me. However, going in reverse was fine because you didn't have to change gears to go in reverse, but you certainly picked up a bit of speed. And so I took off around the property a little bit, and I was doing all things fine until I decided I'd reverse into the shed. And, you know, my uncle parked a big combine harvester in the middle of that thing there, and I wasn't real good at working out distances, particularly when you go from bright sunlight to dark shed, and bang, no one noticed, which was fine. And I'm surprised I didn't get busted even to this day for running into the combine harvester, but that was okay. And I didn't get busted either when my uncle said it was okay to take the ute, and so Spike and I thought we'd go for a hunting trip. And so we got some rifles, put them in the car, and we took turns driving down the dirt roads, the red dirt roads of the outback Queensland, and took off, fanging down the highways there, and the dirt roads, just taking off. And we were like rednecks, like we were after anything that would move. You know, kangaroos, rabbits, foxes, anything that would move. We didn't see anything that moved, so we thought we'd take a pot shot at a tree or two, because we had guns, we had a car, we were feeling like adults, and we took off. I had to wait, really, for another 4 years until I could learn to drive proper. And then I needed to prove myself. I discovered that if I was going to have the car, I needed to prove myself to my parents. If I wanted access to the car when I had my P's, they wanted to know that I could take care of a car worth tens of thousands of dollars. They would say to me, "You just need to show us that we can trust you with this car, that you can be responsible. If you want the car, then make sure you drive properly." And then another thing I learnt was that if they asked me when I would be home and I said 10:30 but got home at 11, that was not acceptable. If I said I was going to be home at 10:30, I needed to be home at 10:30. because they wanted to know if I was trustworthy, if I was responsible. And I did work out, so if you're still living home with the rentals and you're not quite sure how this works, take notes. When they ask you what time you'll be home, you think about what time you think you'll be home, then add half an hour to it. And so if you're going to be home at 11, say 11:30 and get home at 11. It's great. You get a whole lot of trust built up with your parents right there. That's worth the price of entry to church right there. Now that I'm a rental myself, I'm discovering that trust is a crucial building block in relationships. I see that trust is something that needs to be developed, and it needs to be developed in people, because none of us comes out of the womb with 100% trust factor. We need to learn to be trusted in order for people to entrust us with stuff. And you develop trustworthiness in someone by training them how to be trustworthy. Now, my kids have learned how to be trustworthy with the car. In fact, I have such confidence in them, I am so trusting of them, I don't wait up for them when they go out, never have. When they go out at night, I go to bed, if it's past my bedtime, which is not hard to do now that I'm an old bloke, I go to bed and get horizontal, and I realise that some of you want to call docs and report me for being, you know, into child abuse and stuff like that, but I've just figured that my wife and I have trained them so well in the car that we can trust them with the car. We train their eyes, for example, to see two or three cars ahead all the time, so that if the car two or three ahead is slowing up, then you slow up now. Don't wait for the guy in front of you to put his brakes on, because he's half asleep and he'll prop too late. I taught them to watch with their eyes. If a ball comes across the road, to slow up, because a child will follow the ball. Children have no idea about how roads work, so slow up when you see a ball coming, because a child will follow. If a dog or a cat runs across your path, do not slam on the brakes. Now, I don't mind. I have a dog. I don't mind him. I put up with cats. But if a dog or a cat runs in front of a car, they are nowhere near as valuable as the people in the car with you. And so it is better to kill the dog than kill some human being. So we've taught them all of that. And again, you know, you might want to ring the RSPCA now, of course, and report me on that account as well. But because we trained our children well in a car, we've learnt to trust them. We're confident that they are trustworthy and that they are good drivers. If there's an accident, they'll give us a call because they've got phones. If it's a bad accident, the police will get me out of bed and I will deal with it then and there. Does this mean I don't love my kids? No, exactly the opposite. We've just trained them to be trustworthy. And so we can entrust them with a car. Trust is crucial not only for good driving, but for every aspect of life. Now, men, listen up. A trustworthy man will find that his wife will entrust her soul to him all her days. Ladies, listen up. A trustworthy mother will discover that her children will entrust their lives to her care. All of you who work, listen up. A trustworthy employee will find a boss will entrust them with more responsibility. It's just how it works. We're in a short series looking at how to build a life when making a living is paramount. How to build a life when making a living is paramount. It's one thing to make a living, but how do you build a life? You could get a life coach, I expect. But you don't need to spend your money that way. Not when God uses your money to build your life. Now let me explain that to you. It's a bit of a surprise first up, I know. God uses money and wealth and possessions to build your life. He allows us to have access to almost unprecedented wealth in this city because he wants to use it to train us to be trustworthy. Let me show you from the passage that Phil just read out. So if you've got your notes, open them up and have a look at the passage or open up a Bible. I want to dive into verse 10 where Jesus says, "Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Now, you see in the outline there that God, what we're looking at here right now is God uses money because it reveals our trustworthiness. Money does double duty here, trains us in building a life, and it develops trustworthiness in us. So look again, verse 10 and 11. Have a pen in ready, and you can either underline your Bible, not the church's one, or underline the passage that you have there where I say. So whoever can be trusted, underline the word trusted, with very little, can also be trusted, underline that, with very much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? See, any employer knows, or any employee rather knows, that if he cannot be trusted with $10, his boss is not going to put him in charge of $10 million. Take Marty Kemp, for example. If I knew Marty Kemp could not take care of his own finances, I would not have put him in charge of a $300,000 a year ministry we call young adults. Any parent knows that if you can't trust a child to take care of the car while you're sitting in the car with them, then why would you give them a car when they're on their P's? If they cannot take care of the car when there's no risk to them because you're sitting in the car with them, why would you give them a car when they put themselves in the risk's firing line? And that's the thinking here behind verses 11 and 12. Now let me ask you a question. Do you know this man? Who is that? Kerry Packer, that's right. Do you know this man? James Packer. Kerry is the father, James is the son. Kerry Packer handed over his empire to his son James. He just didn't wake up one day and say, you know what, I've had enough, I think I'll give it to James. Didn't wake up thinking that. He invested his life in making this empire massive. He'd been so good at it, he'd seen so much exponential growth in his empire that he was not only Australia's richest man, but one of the world's richest men. And you get a bit of an idea of how rich he was from a poker game he was engaged in I think Las Vegas. He was playing, and there was a Texan who was a bit loud-mouthed playing gambling, and he kept on about how much he was worth and how powerful he was and how much money he had. And Kerry could only take that sort of talk for so long. And so he said to the guy, what are you worth? He said, oh, about $40 million. Kerry said, I'll toss you for it. Kerry had a lot of money. So Kerry puts James into a relatively small operation in the Packer Empire to see how he would go. How could he cope with the board that would push him around and push back? How is he going to handle pushback from powerful people? How would he handle criticism from the media and powerful people? How would he handle the accolades that would come his way because of the decisions he made? Because if James Packer was unable to handle the complexities and the pressure at this level, if he could not do it there, then Kerry would not put him in charge of the whole empire. I have no doubt that Kerry trained James from a very early age. I have no doubt that people visited the Packer household who were very prominent, very significant, very powerful business leaders on the world scale. James was sent to particular schools in order to learn things in a particular way, all of which was aimed at shaping and grooming James Packer for the great responsibility and the great reward of overseeing the Packer empire. Jesus says in verse 10 and 12, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will be dishonest with much. So, if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? You note here that Jesus has something far more valuable in mind than money. He wants to give us something of far greater significance than worldly wealth. You get a bit of an idea of how much Jesus thinks of worldly wealth if you look at the end of the reading that Phil read out, where Jesus says, what is highly valued among men, that would be money, is detestable in God's sight. You get another idea from it when we realize that according to the book of Revelation, the streets in heaven are paved with gold. And so if someone was to win lotto in heaven, and a truckload of cash turned up, that would be like us winning Lotto now and a truckload of bitumen turning up, wouldn't it? Like, what value is it? Jesus wants to give us something of far more value. If we're going to receive that, we need to be trustworthy with the money he's given us. Jesus' words tell us as we develop trustworthiness, as we prove ourselves trustworthy with money, then he will give us true riches. If we cannot be trusted with little, he will not entrust us with much. The question then comes, what do we need to do to learn to be trustworthy? Glad you asked. We need to learn how to do this. We need to learn how to do it. And if we will learn this, this will be good for you, particularly whoever asked the question last week. I feel overwhelmed at the thought of dealing with money. If you will learn the lessons tonight, your sense of being overwhelmed will diminish. This will be good for you if your mobile phone bill is way out of control. This will be good for you if your credit card debt is getting the better of you. This will help you plan for the future so that you can not just simply survive but march through the next global financial crisis, and that will come. Most of us in this room are young enough for me to say to you, you will experience 2, 3, or 4 more global financial crises before you breathe your last. If we begin to do these lessons, we will do more than survive economically. And you begin by learning to live within your means. Learn to live within your means. That is, don't spend more than you earn. So, you've got a phone plan. Can you afford to pay the phone plan without going to the rentals? You have a car. Can you afford to pay the petrol, the registration, insurance, and replace the tyres every 50 to 70,000 Ks without going to the rentals? You're buying a unit or a house. Can you afford the repayments at 25 points higher than your current rate? Living within our means is very significant, particularly for Australians who, on average now, spend 114% of what they earn. That is, for every $100 the average Australian earns, they spend 114. If we live on what we earn, then we will become trustworthy in God's eyes. Now, here are 3 simple steps to get into training. You ready? Here they are. First one is, make all you can. Secondly, save all you can. Thirdly, give all you can. So look at this. Firstly, make all you can. Earn money enthusiastically and honestly. If you do that, then Paul says in 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, that you'll be able to provide for and care for your family. And if you're in a business, if you own a business, then you'll be able to provide tools of trade, stock or capital to carry out your business. Live within your means. Earn as much as you can, enthusiastically and honestly. Live within your means. And that means also avoiding consumer debt like the plague. Debt is not your friend. Proverbs 22:7 tells us that debt, it makes slaves of us. Proverbs 22:7. Debt makes slaves of us. Debt enslaves a man or a woman, not only to the one to whom money is owed, but there's increased pressure on you to earn more money, to pay off the debt. See how it works? If you're in debt, then you're a slave to the one you owe money to, and you have increased pressure put upon you to make more money because of the debt. Now let me show you what I mean here. Just imagine for a moment that you have a somewhat average credit card debt, and it stands at $5,000. That's what's on your credit card right now. Let's imagine I give you a pair of scissors now, you cut up your credit card, never use it again, but you're committed to paying the debt off. And you're committed to paying the debt off at the minimum monthly repayment, because that's what the bank calls for, at least the minimum monthly repayment. That's what you're going to pay off. Now, I turned to our youth pastor extraordinaire, who was a super accountant, and asked him to work out how long that would take. Just write a figure down somewhere. How long do you think it would take to pay off $5,000 on your credit card if you paid the minimum repayments a month? Got a figure in your mind? Just hold it there. This is what Rod Bishop worked out for me. 32 years, 7 months to pay off $5,000. If you do that, you will spend an extra $12,500 paying off debt. That $12,500 of interest repayments is money slipping through your fingers. Money for food, clothing, toys and tucker. Money to sponsor a child in Kenya. Money to help the poor across the city. Money for gospel ministry here in the city, in the Hills District, slipping through your fingers. Now, to get some comprehension of what the 32 years looks like, just take your age. Let me take the age of someone here, 22 years. Let me add 32 to that. That comes to 54, which puts the 22-year-old, when they pay their credit card debt off, at the same age as their father is now. So, do you want to spend your life from here until your father's age paying off $5,000 and letting money slip through your fingers? If you're in debt, you are a slave to it. So, make all you can and live within your means. By reverse analogy, if we took that $5,000 and put that in the bank for the same 32 years, at the end of the time, you'd have more than $21,000 in the bank. Which would you rather have? So, how do you live within your means? Earn all you can, avoid debt. Second thing is, save all you can. In Proverbs 6, there's a lovely passage here, Proverbs 6, verses 6 to 11. Let me read it to you. Go to the ant, you sluggard. It's very impressive, very gentle language. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food in harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man. Proverbs is saying, save all you can. Learn from the ants who store up things for another day. Save all you can. This calls for regular, disciplined deposits into a savings account. You know that's actually legal to save? You can do this. You can take money and put it in a savings account. My wife and I, we take 10% of our savings and put them into a savings account. That means we have money for holidays, retirement, rainy days and downturns. I wish I'd heard this piece of information when I was your age. So I'm now speaking like a father because I'm in my 50s. I'm allowed to. If I wish I'd learnt this in my 20s. I should have saved in the bank, in my savings account, enough money to cover 6 months' salary should I lose my job. So that, if I lose my job, I have money to live on while I go find another job. If you do this sort of thing, put money away, then from this account you can do the third thing, which is give all you can. And that means we can become increasingly like Jesus, who Marty talked to us about last week. Generous. We can be generous. Our God calls us to be disciplined in giving. So let me talk about a couple of ways to do this. Earn all you can, save all you can, and give all you can. So I want to do some mathematics with you. I know that not all of us are mathematicians. I know that some of us watch the TV show Numbers, but that's about as far as it goes. We get lost in all that mathematics there. And when I can do elementary maths, but when I want to determine how long this sort of stuff goes on, I've got to talk to Rod Bishop or Colin Grundy, our general manager. So let me explain this in terms that I get. I'm going to go over it a couple of times because I know it's complex, but we'll see how we go, okay? It's a simple principle found in the Bible. It goes like this. Every time you get 10 of these, you take one and give it to the work of God. Now, I know that's complicated, so let me do it again. Every time you get 10 of these, you take one and give it to the work of God. If you follow the 10-10-80 rule, you'll take a second one, every time you get 10 of these, and put it in a savings account. How much do I have left over to live on? Take a wild guess. Let me do it again. 10 of these take one, work of God, take one, savings. How much do I have left to live on?
80.
Thank you so much. It's painful, isn't it? No, you can't stand it. That's it. You have 80 to live on. I have been doing the first one, the 10%, since I was 15. 36 years. And I've never found God to leave me without money to live on. It was easy when I started to work at the age of 15, just after I was converted, because I was getting paid a grand total of 20 bucks a week at Woolies up here. And then to tithe, to take 10% was 2 bucks. That doesn't sound like a lot of money now, but back then I could fill my car up for 2 bucks. Okay, so it took 2 bucks, put it in the plate. If I save this second 10, then I have money to be generous. And I've been growing in that along with my wife. I remember the first time we gave 500 of these away to friends in college who were in desperate need. We took some of our savings, we were college students, and gave it to them. Another time we had a house that we were using as an investment property, sorely needed some carpet because it was threadbare, the carpet in our house. We were given brand new carpet, enough to cover our whole house and then some. And then God introduced us to some friends who were in more desperate need than we were for carpet in their house so that they could do what they needed to do. And so we gave it to them. You need to grow to be generous by being disciplined in your giving, by saving so that you can be generous. If you have just felt a pain in your chest or in your hip, it's because finance has too big a grip on your soul. Because Jesus says in verse 13, look at it. No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And the Pharisees sneered at Jesus, and he said to him, you are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of men, but God knows your hearts. What is highly valued amongst men is detestable in God's sight. Now, to make this point a little clearer, I'm going to invite the Bears up. Where are you guys? So here, come on up, Darren. When they get close enough, I'll ask you to welcome them to the platform, but just they're way down the back. Why don't you make them feel welcome? This is Kerry Ann and Darren Bear. Kerry Ann is our marketing manager, our communications manager here at church. Darren is a key player in our men's ministry, and they've been very kind in allowing me to ask them some questions. We did this at 5 o'clock. We did it at 10 o'clock in July. And this story is still a little raw, and so I have increasing respect for them. Now, let me bring us up to speed a little bit here. Darren was on a very, very, very healthy salary, six-figure salary with a particular company a number of years ago. He also enjoyed that sort of salary and the lifestyle that went with it, and ended up buying himself a grey Mercedes. Okay, and so. I want to ask you, Darren, so why did you do that? What was lying behind you buying the Mercedes?
Because I could, and it was just pure self-indulgence.
Okay. Now, listen to this. Let me ask Kerry-Ann, when did you know about the Mercedes?
I knew on the Thursday night when the keys went on the bench.
So where was the car?
In the garage.
So you drove home with a brand new Mercedes and just said to my wife, your wife, this is a new car.
I cried. He was excited. It wasn't...
No, you cried. You mean you really cried.
I cried.
Yep.
I cried for a long time, actually. I cried. And every time we drove to church, I cried even more. Because it just made... It was just a piercing reminder of how frivolous we, i.e. when you're married, it's a we, were with our money.
Okay. So what did it mean for you to have this car? Like, apart from the frivolity, you said at 5 o'clock, you know, you thought of different things that it meant.
Yeah, basically it meant it was like poison to have that car for our family, for our children. They've seen a whole lot of fighting about it. For our parents, they've seen irrational decisions made for their children, who they, I suppose, thought that they taught about finances. And for our immediate Christian friends, I think it was a huge shock. And it basically came to a point where I said, I need to walk out the door because the car repayment exceeds the mortgage repayment.
Okay, now, when you say walk out the door, you mean walk away from Darren, their whole lot?
Absolutely. Walk away, take the children, walk away from, because it was continuing and not stopping at the Mercedes.
Okay. Now, Darren, what did that do to you when Kerri-Ann said to you, that's enough?
Well, that was a real turning point at that point, yeah, because it had been very self-indulgent up until then. Mm. So when Kerri was speaking about leaving, then that's when it all, the lifestyle certainly hit home.
Okay. Do you regret selling the Mercedes?
No. No, I didn't. Because that was, you know, that was a very much a symbolic event in getting rid of the things that were making Kerri stumble.
Okay. Now, we want to add here: there's nothing wrong with owning a Mercedes. There's nothing wrong with having a lot of money. There's nothing wrong with it. What was wrong was what was doing to Darren's heart and this relationship, and the symbolism of. You heard him say a couple of times: the symbolism of this was not a good thing. It was serving two masters, or trying to, yes?
Mm-hmm. Very much. Yeah.
Money and God. Go on.
And it sneaks up on you as well. You know, you think that it's something that you've got under control. And I used to come and sit in 10 o'clock and listen to sermon week after week. And you think it's not affecting you, and you think that you've got it all under control. You can be wealthy and have a massive career and be good at church as well. But while you think you're in control, your wife and all our friends could see me going left and Kerri going right. So, okay. Yeah.
I remember the day when you came to me and said, I'm going to sell a Merc. That was a good day for me. I thought, yes.
I think it was a good day for lots of people.
It was a great day for me.
Now, did you hear what happened here? The good thing is that while Kerri-Ann said, I've had enough, I'm ready to walk out the door, under God, they've restored their relationship, rebuilt it, and it is a good relationship to watch. And so on. So thank you so much for sharing. It's not an easy story, but thank you so much. If we want to learn to be trustworthy, if we want to be entrusted with true riches from God, then we need to get on to this. You can follow the 10-10-80 rule, which is 10%, you know, get 10 of these, take one, give it to the work of God. Take another one, put it in savings, live off the 80. Or you can go 10, 10, 10, 70, 10 to the work of God, 10 to savings, 10 to pay off your credit debts, live off 70. Some of you might say, I can't do that. Well, yes, you can. It just needs some discipline, some reorientation. And I would suggest to you, if tomorrow you go to work and your boss comes to you and says, either you take a 20% reduction in salary or you go away, I think you would make the adjustments. So here's a question now. Why do you have access to so much money? Why do I have access to so much money? Why is it that even our Year 7 high school students have handled more money today than 5.7 billion, that's with a B, 5.7 billion people have handled today. 5.7 billion people on our planet live on less than $2 a day. The only coffee you can buy in the Hills District for $2 is here at Malachi's. Why do we have access to so much money? It is not so that we can simply live debt-free. That's important. But the answer to my question is found in verse 9. These are Jesus' words. I tell you, use worldly wealth, your money, to gain friends for yourselves, so that when money is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Here is the short story on what that means. Jesus is saying, use money to introduce people to Jesus. Buy friends, eternal friends. Use your money so that people will hear about Jesus. And then they will welcome you into heaven on the last day. Because they'll line up and say, because you took one and invested that in the kingdom. I heard about Jesus at Castle Hill High School. I heard about Jesus at the RA Club. I heard about Jesus at the Mardi Gras. I heard about Jesus in Kenya. I heard about Jesus because you were disciplined in your giving. I heard about Jesus, and they'll be grateful. I get to spend eternity with you, but more importantly, I get to spend it with Jesus. Thank you for investing in me, they will say. Life in the hills is good, but it's not free from the effects of sin. A grandmother I could introduce you to, whose husband held a rifle to her head, will tell you that. A woman who told me today her marriage was over will tell you that. A grandfather who watched his granddaughter pass away at the age of 4 will tell you that. They will all tell you that life in the hills is good, but it's not heaven. So Jesus says, use your worldly wealth, that which I place in your hands, that which I've entrusted to your care, so that I might develop and build a life in you. Would you use it to build friends for the kingdom? Would you do that, he says. That's why I give you the money. And so we need to ask ourselves the question, how can I use the wealth Jesus places in my hands to make friends? How can I do that? Jesus says, I've given you access to so much, unprecedented wealth. Use it to make friends. And as you grow in trustworthiness, as you build a life, you will attract the highest accolade possible. In Luke 19, verse 17, Jesus tells yet another story about money. He says, there will come a day when I will line my servants up, and those who I have entrusted money with, and those who are trustworthy, those who built a life that I wanted them to build, I will say to them, well done, good and faithful servant. Well done. And my brothers and sisters, when you hear those words, you will know that you have built a life and not just made a living. Let me pray. Father, we thank you that you are an extraordinarily generous God. And we thank you that you have placed us in this country at this time, for you tell us that you set the exact times and the exact locations in which men should live in order that they should seek you out. Thank you that you've called us to know you. Would you please keep shaping us that we might be men and women whose lives are worth living? Would you help us to work out how to leverage all of the resources you've given to us so that your name is made famous and those who do not know you will get a place at your table? And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Any questions there? How many? 4. I thought you said 11. Strike. Let's see what we've got. Should we pay our unserved friends to come to church? Isn't that a direct application? No, I don't think it is a direct application. Though, if you want to pay me to come to church, I'm happy. I think you do pay me to come to church. No, it's not a direct application. The whole sense of Scripture is that we would use our money to be generous, that we would take care of the poor, that we would do this, food, toys and tucker for people who have nothing. So the people would go, why do you do that? And we'll say, because Jesus is generous and we want to be generous. We want to make his name famous. So yeah, now that, if I may say, is a bit on a crass side of application. Next question. Where does buying a house come in to earn, save, give? Is expected of my age group, but I'm worried about becoming a slave to mortgage. That's a very good question. You don't have to have a mortgage. You can rent all your life. Most of Europe does that. It's just how the property market works in Europe. Though we have the opportunity here in Australia, there is an argument, which is the one that I hold to because I have a mortgage, and that is this, that it's actually better money to put the money into something that will serve me into my retirement than to put the money into someone else's pocket that will serve them into their retirement. And so if I can take care of my family, if I roll the tape into the future and I'm in my old dotage, and I own the home, then my kids will not have the burden of taking care of me in an old folks home. I could sell the home and we could move into an old folks home. And so it's that sort of stewardship argument that I have with it. You just need to be careful how big your home is that you buy. If you come to my house, which you are welcome to do, you might walk in and go, because that happened when we had a young adults group. We finished the house, a young adults group came and joined us, and they were like starstruck at the size of the place and, you know, everything. They think we paid much more for it than we actually did. I'm happy to divulge what we paid for. It's not what you think when you look at it, what we paid. We got a really good deal. But having said all of that, we didn't walk from university into that home. We walked into that home after 20 years of investing wisely as we could. We took $10,000 and turned that into the home that we now live in. So don't think you should walk into your parents' house standard now. Okay, work up to it. Yep, and if you're a slave, if you're worried about slave to mortgage, talk to your husband, talk to your wife, get that sorted out. You don't have to be a slave to the mortgage if you can do things like pay the mortgage off at the rate that it's set now, plus 2.5% on top, so that you can ride the market. If you can't do that, then don't do it. My lender wanted us to take out more money, and we just said, no. Oh, no, you'll need to buy more furniture because, you know, new house, you want new furniture, you don't want the old stuff. We said, no. We want to borrow this much. But you could borrow this much on yourself. We said, no, here. Like, that conversation went on for about 10 minutes. And finally said, which part of the word no don't you understand? This is how much we want to borrow. That's it. Because we know we can afford that and this, but we don't want to borrow that because we won't be able to afford it when it goes up. Does that make sense? Yes? Good. Next question. Isn't 10% an Old Testament amount? Isn't this just a starting point? Shouldn't we give more? Yes, yes, yes. In fact, 10% is not the only piece. If we added up all of the contributions the Old Testament people should give, it would come to something like 23%. So we need to take that into account. It's very complex to work that out. Isn't it just a starting point? Absolutely. Shouldn't we give more? Absolutely. Absolutely. If I'm being clear. Absolutely. Do you know that the Muslim world, you know what their goal is? Let me tell you, their goal is to have the whole world serving Allah this century. Do you know how much money they're investing in that little program? Good Muslims put 20% of their income into that false dream. We are trying to win the world to Jesus. Give more, of course. Marty talked about reverse tithing last week. Love to be in a position to do that at some stage. Next question. It's not just, tithing is not just mentioned in the Old Testament. Matthew 23:23, Jesus says to the Pharisees, they're always a bit thing with Jesus. He said to them, you tithe mint and cumin, the smallest of spices, while neglecting the more important issues of justice and mercy. And then he says, you should have done the latter, that is justice and mercy, without neglecting the former, that is tithing. So I think there's a little window there to talk about tithing for Christians. Okay. Now, I'm going to take a little liberty here. I know it's late, but you're big boys and girls, you'll cope with this. There were some really helpful conversations that took place after last Sunday night through the week, and I just wanted to see if I could anticipate and deal with a question or two. Often it's asked of us, what is the church giving away? How much money is it investing in the mission field? You know, you talk all this stuff about tithing and carry on. Why shouldn't we tithe our money as a church? Well, I'm here to tell you that we don't tithe as a church. The reality is we're doing far better than that. First thing I want to say on the tithing thing, it's a category error to move from individuals who are called upon to tithe to a group of people. Nowhere in the scriptures is a group of people called upon to tithe. But individuals are. Secondly, this year, if our figures are anywhere near correct, and we think they are, if we take into account everything that, like, let me ask this question. Who is the church? Who is the church? Us. So, if we take into account all the stuff that us does as a group, toys and tucker, contributing to the well in Kibera, Kibera cards, one-off donations to things like bushfire appeals in Victoria, other things like that, plus our sponsorship as a church of 252 children in Africa, if we add all that together, on top of what we give anyway to the mission field, we are giving away something in excess of $300,000 this year. That comes to around about 20 to 22%. Is that clear? It is. And and 10 years ago, it was under $100,000. Now, can we put that one to bed? Can we put that to bed now? It would be helpful if you said yes. Because that is a work of God amongst us, is it not? Thank you.
Let's respond.